So welcome to the next edition of the Rare Business Podcast. With me today, I have Peter Chris, Senior Research Scientist at Medallia. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Ray. Thank you.
So how are you doing today? You all right?
I'm fine. I'm glad to be joining you.
Fantastic. So, Peter, for the benefit of our listeners and readers, can you tell us a bit about you and also a little bit about the work that you do?
Sure, of course. So the most relevant thing about me probably is that I'm fascinated by how people make decisions.
Okay.
Before Medallia, I was at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, in the Department of Social and Decision Sciences, which is a group of economists and psychologists and others, like mathematicians and historians,
okay,
all studying how people make decisions.
Cool.
So most of my work there, starting at the beginning, was through lab experiments. So for the most part, we would bring students into a computer lab and have them play games for money. So we changed things like how competitive the games are, how cooperative they are, whether they can communicate, whether they can lie, and see what we can learn about the reasons people do the things they do.
Okay.
So one of the things I was really interested in there, I still am, is social preferences. That is, like, how and when people care about fairness and willingness to pay to punish people who act unfairly,
right,
things like that.
Okay.
And then one of my other focuses was on trying to better understand communication and how it can be structured to get people to better outcomes.
Okay. Wow. So, big science. That's good stuff.
Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah, it's fascinating for me because I remember I have a background as an economist, but while I was studying economics, I also studied psychology. And so I have a big interest in the crossover of psychology and economics and sort of behavioral sort of stuff. But I actually had to pick one or the other to specialize in, and I ended up picking economics because I actually thought that would be more likely to get me a job later in life. But actually, on reflection now, I actually, where my interests kind of lie now, I actually feel like I would have possibly preferred to have studied more psychology, because I just think understanding how people behave and how they make decisions is just a really, really valuable thing, particularly in today's market.
Yeah, I think it's totally fascinating. We've been studying it for maybe since second grade or so.
Okay.
So I'm a huge fan of that intersection, I think, but has a lot of applications, of course.
Excellent. Now, the thing that brought us together is that the fact that you recently published an article on the Harvard Business Review called The Value of Customer Experience Quantified. And I thought it was a fascinating article, and that's why I wanted to talk to you about. I wanted to talk to you about that today. And so can you tell me a little bit more about the article and how it came about and why you wrote it?
Sure. I might actually back up a little bit first to get some context around the why.
Okay.
So my work in general here at Medallia, and not just my work, but the work that we all do, flows, to me at least, pretty directly from what I learned through the communication experiments.
Right.
One of the big patterns that we see when you study these things is that in perfectly cooperative settings, letting people communicate basically works. If you let them talk, then they generally agree on doing the things best for both of them. That's not so surprising.
Yeah.
And then in situations that are very competitive in the sense that one person's gain is another person's loss, communication generally doesn't help very much.
Yeah.
Also not that surprising.
Okay.
But we really don't understand the situations in between very well. So there are a lot of contexts that are strategic and somewhat cooperative, but there's also a level of competition or risk that makes people's interests not perfectly aligned.
Right.
And in those situations, sometimes communication helps, sometimes it doesn't, sometimes just being able to communicate helps, even if you don't actually do it. It's very strange. So, this is exciting to me because it means that we have a really big opportunity.
Okay.
Because a huge number of the problems in the world are in this middle ground. And one of the biggest examples of these not purely competitive, not purely cooperative situations is between companies and their customers.
Okay, yeah.
So go ahead.
No, no, I was just acknowledging the point, saying, yeah, okay, I can see how that those sort of relationships and those points of contact and communication opportunities, I guess, would sit in the middle. They're neither completely competitive and they're neither completely collaborative either, I guess.
Exactly.
Okay.
So it's interesting to me how, in different industries in particular, companies sort of at least act like they see that relationship either more, as more competitive or more cooperative. So telecoms are, at least in the U.S., one notorious example of this. Some are better than others, of course, but they sometimes act like they're playing this game of, I want your money, you don't want to give it to me, so how can I get it from you?
Yeah.
And so they trap you into contracts and they have intentional confusing billing and so on. And I believe, and it's very consistent with our philosophy here at Medallia, that a far better business strategy for the long run is to figure out how to be cooperative with your customers.
Yeah.
So to find out what they want and need that you can provide at a reasonable cost,
mm-hmm.
and they'll actually willingly pay you for it. You don't have to. And this is, of course, not a new idea, and it's easier said than done, which kind of brings us to the work of Medallia. So we're trying to solve this communication problem in a way that enables these companies to learn faster than they could otherwise.
Right.
And we do that by trying to get that communication between frontline employees and customers they serve, make that as fast and seamless and action-oriented as possible. So, long intro to the question of this particular article. So, a lot of people talk about, of course, customer experience and how important it is. But we found, actually, looking around, that it's really hard to find published results from real companies showing how much having a better experience actually influences the customer spending.
Right.
It's easy to write down a model, but of course you want real data behind it. So some companies, of course, do this privately with their own data. But I've been surprised at how many actually not even taking that step. And this is, I think, a big problem because it's one of these situations where if leaders and companies understood how important it was, and they would make decisions that would be both better for them and the company and better for their customers.
Uh-huh.
So by not doing this, we're just kind of leaving value on the table that's really good for everyone. Well, except maybe your competitors.
Yeah.
It's good for the company and good for those who serve. So that's what brought us to doing these studies. The concept, I assume most listeners have not read it. The concept was to take two major companies with very different business models, one transactional and one subscription-based, and apply some modeling techniques and leverage the fact that we have feedback from customers and also future behavioral data from those customers, how much they actually spend and when.
Right.
And use that information to estimate how much more their customers spend if they had a great experience or a great history of experience instead of a poor experience.
Can I just interrupt? So were you actually taking a whole data set and then sort of going back and making some assumptions about what they would like to do in the future, and then because you then say take it forward again, and because you've already got the data, it's historical, you can match your assumptions and the results that you would have got from a predictive model against actually what happened.
So we used the data we had to build the model.
Okay.
So what was really nice about the data set was that we were able to construct it such that we had a point in time measure or a kind of account from the customer,
yeah.
of the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had their future behavior after that point.
Right.
So I think that time element is critical. And it's also critical that we have other information about those customers, like their age, how long they've been a customer, the type of traveler they are, for example, in our hospitality case with the basis of the subscription, or sorry, the transactional study. So does that answer your question, or am I missing the point?
Yeah, no, I think so. I think it's, I mean, it's because my background, I've done quite a lot of sort of modeling and forecasting and stuff, and sometimes it's a lot of people forecast without actually kind of then monitoring kind of how well their forecasts do going forward, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
And that can,
yeah.
that can be a real Achilles heel in forecasting. So they never actually amend and iterate their models based on actually what happens. It's all just about the forecasts.
Right. Yeah. So we've not gotten to the stage of, we didn't flip the sample and do out-of-sample predictions in this case.
Okay.
In principle, I think that's incredibly important to do.
Yeah.
In general. In this case, the models are not very complex, so I'm not very worried about overfitting.
Okay.
And there's a huge amount of data. So we're talking like half a million customers. Now, more data is not a solution to every problem. I'm very aware of that.
Sure.
But, so we were not the right way to describe it. I mean, we're looking to estimate the effect size of the experience controlling for other things that we know matter.
Uh-huh.
And we're able to do that, I think, reasonably well. And we do find consistent results, for example, when we've looked at other hospitality brands.
Right.
So in some sense, that is, it's not out of sample prediction and since we're actually applying the model, but we are we're not finding vastly different results when we look in different contexts.
Okay. And sort of in broad-based terms, what were your big findings out of the research that you did?
Sure. So we found that in the transactional business, spending over the following year was 140% higher following a great experience rather than a poor experience. So, a multiplier of 2.4.
Okay.
In the subscription business, that's driven by repeat visits, in this case, it's in hospitality.
Uh-huh.
And then in the subscription business, going from those that have the fourth experience, the best experience, here the outcome variable is retention.
Uh-huh.
And goes from 43% to 74%. So that, of course, on an annual basis, you can project into the future what that means about how long you'll actually be a member.
Yeah.
And so we estimated that goes from about a little over a year for those that had the worst experience to an average of about 6 years for those with the best experience. So depending on how far you're kind of moving in the lifetime value direction, we're seeing a huge multiplier in the subscription business as well.
Wow. That's a big numbers. That's fantastic. I mean, but when you're talking about in the research and classifying the research in the different businesses that you looked at and the different business models, I mean, what did you define as, and I think this is a key thing that I sort of think about, what do you define as investment in customer experience? Because a lot of people will get caught up and go, oh, customer experience is a lot of it's about technology. But I just wanted to clarify what you've captured as is investment in customer experience.
Sure, that's a question. I mean, this study that we wrote up most recently was really just looking at naturally occurring variation in experience. So we don't actually know what causes individual differences. We're doing other work that's very closely related to that.
Right.
So in terms of what an investment in customer experience is, I mean, to me, that just means spending your limited resources on things that make your customers better off. Right. Like you're pointing out, that's a huge category of things.
Well, it could be everything.
So it includes everything from capital investments like renovating lobbies or a hotel to employee training programs that help your frontline empathize or take action.
Yeah.
Modifications to a call center phone tree that prevent a segment of customers from falling between the cracks.
Yeah.
The trick, of course, is, there's a million things you can do, choosing the right investments. And one way to think about that is there are things you could do as a company that are cheap and things that are expensive, customer-focused initiatives. And then there are things that improve your customer's experience and things they wouldn't even notice.
Yeah.
And it's not always true that the expensive things are the things that matter. So you want to find areas for improvement that have a disproportionate positive impact on your customer. And these really aren't always expensive. So, I mean, it could be as simple as, I take the hospitality case because I'm familiar with it, thanking members of the military for their service when they check into your hotel.
Yeah.
Cost nothing.
Yeah.
Has a huge impact.
Yeah.
So finding those things that, when you're operating on a human level, make complete sense. There's no mystery behind them. But understanding what they are and being able to find them, and especially in a huge organization, you don't need to have all these ideas becoming top-down.
No.
In fact, it's possible for them to be. So to set up a system where those ideas, you're kind of creating a culture and environment where those ideas happen and they get tried and they either work or they don't, mm-hmm. and you have the organization wired to be getting the feedback to see when things work. And that way the good ideas can bubble up and be expanded more broadly, and those that don't. And they fail at extremely low cost. Tough kind of division.
And so, do you think that? Because I think I've got a couple of questions around. What do you think the key lessons are for firms sort of listening in from your research? But also the second part of the question as well is about whether or not investing or improving your customer experience is that. Do you think investment returns will decline over time just because of the competitive nature of the market, and therefore it's not a one-shot deal and it has to be a continuous thing? I mean, what does your research tell you about those sort of things?
Good question. So I'm largely in a speculatory territory. I don't have much hard data for you, but I do think it needs to be continuous, but I would not be at all surprised if, you know, as companies make more and more incremental improvements, they get closer and closer to the ceiling, maybe, of what can be achieved incrementally.
Right.
And then at some point, preferably sooner rather than later, you need to actually innovate, not just make these adjustments.
Right.
And I think that thinking, you know, 5, 10 years into the future, companies have to figure out how to do this customer-centered innovation at scale are the ones that will really succeed. So, I mean, how to do that, I have some ideas, but not any case studies, for example, on that. But that's my gut. That's sort of the direction things need to move.
Yeah.
There will be these decreasing marginal returns, but that doesn't mean stop doing it and focus on something else.
Yeah.
It means you need to rethink what doing it means.
Well, I think so. I think you just reminded me of a great sort of quote or sort of piece that I remember from a conversation with a guy. Have you ever heard of a guy called Gary Vaynerchuk?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, so Gary is this big social media kind of commentator and author and thinker and things, and he wrote a book recently called the Thank You Economy. And I was speaking to him about that and a bunch of other things and as part of this interview series. And he said, look, some people talk about customer service and the ability to care not scaling. And he said, I think that's rubbish. I think you need to think about things differently. He says most of these firms are quite happy to pay, say, $3 million for a Super Bowl advertisement. He says, and the ROI on that is questionable at the very best. He says, what would happen if you took that $3 million and say employed 60 different kind of 60 new customer service people at $50,000 a piece and just got them to call your customers to say, hi, how can I help you? Hope everything's okay. He says that sort of stuff that scales, and that's the way that people need to think. They need to think differently.
It reminds me, are you familiar with Rory Sutherland?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so you may have seen this talk that he gave, paraphrasing here. I don't want to ruin this for anybody who's going to listen to it, because it's more better than I will recount it, but talks about the problem of speeding up the train from London to Paris.
Oh, yes.
And that the engineering solution, which they did apparently, was to new tracks from London to the coast. Speed up the train and take off, whatever it was, 30 minutes from the ride. And, this cost billions of pounds to do or something. And he says, maybe naive of him, but he thinks that, speeding up the train ride is kind of a simplistic way to think about improving it.
Yes.
And, that's what's the hedonic opportunity cost of 8 billion pounds or whatever. And he says, well, here's his suggestion is, employ all the world's top male and female supermodels and have them walk up and down the lights of the train handing out champagne for the entire ride, and you still have billions of times left over. People would be asking for the train ride to be longer, not shorter.
Yeah, I've heard of
and,
that.
And, but, think in those terms, that what is, this is, of course, totally standard economic idea, what's the opportunity cost of how you're spending your money and your other resources? Sometimes the big expenses are not even close to the things your customers would care about the most.
Well, absolutely. So it's not sort of faster, better, sort of cheaper. It's faster and cheaper is not necessarily the only way to go. Sometimes better can mean so many other things, and better can be longer or more involved or just different and more memorable, I think. So I've seen Rory do that sort of tell that sort of story, and I think it's a great example of what you can get for thinking differently and doing things differently. So it's fascinating. But so coming back to the first part of the sort of question, what are the key lessons coming out of your research for sort of firms that are thinking about, they're in that customer experience sort of space, they might be average or above average, but they want to push on. What do you think the lessons are for them?
Sure. Well, it makes me think of a different quote I came across recently by the economist Tyler Cohen. He says, information isn't what's scarce, it's the willingness to do something with it.
Right.
And people sometimes implicitly assume that soft customer experience data, soft in the sense that it's, self-reported and it's questions about feelings and intentions, that it won't stand up to kind of hard analysis.
Right.
Like, modeling or any other type of investigative data. And that's just not true. Soft concepts can have big impacts. Just because they're hard to measure doesn't mean they're unimportant.
Yes.
And I'm not even the thousandth person to realize this, but this can be really hard to remember when you're trying to make the case that something hard to measure is valuable, when things that are really easy to measure, like costs, how easy depends, of course, but easier to measure like costs are, being compared to each other. So I think the lesson is to give your data the opportunity to speak for itself, and whether you're off by 5% or 10% is often totally irrelevant when you're talking about, effects of orders of magnitude, between one investment or another, and sort of don't ignore the things that feel soft because people are soft.
Well, exactly. I think that's it's a great point, and if you want to measure the effects of something, then start small and try things, and then kind of measure what their impact is. And if you're not convinced by soft stuff because you're driven by what is measurable and kind of hard numbers, then if you want to start on soft initiatives, then maybe start small. Start things like maybe get everybody to say hi to everybody else kind of as soon as they enter the building and see what happens. It's a journey, but I think it's a journey towards trying to make our businesses more human in many respects.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more.
Excellent. So, it's fascinating stuff, and it's great results. It's the first time I've actually seen this type of kind of work done in such a I actually think in such a rigorous kind of way. So I think it's quite the data is kind of quite compelling. But is there, on the back of this kind of research, is there anything else that you'd like to add or insights that we've could possibly kind of missed that you'd like to share with our listeners and readers?
Well, we're sort of bringing it up. One of the biggest kind of general lessons from the research on communication is that people don't do it enough, and there's a large role for experimentation there.
Right.
Part of the reason that I think people tend to overestimate, or just part of the reason people don't communicate enough, is they tend to overestimate how much other people already know what they themselves know.
Yes.
And so people don't communicate, even in cooperative situations, and they then fail to do things that would make everybody better off.
Yeah.
So the top tip, which is very general and not original, is just communicate. So ask yourself, what am I assuming about what the people I'm trying to cooperate with, whether they be your customers or your colleagues or your partners, that what are you assuming they know that they may not already know?
Yeah.
And it's more likely, I'm trying to phrase this in a not totally confusing way, it's more likely than you think that they don't know it.
Yes.
And I'm trying to think about how exactly this fits into experimentation, especially in business, but it's sort of a strange thing to plug. But the thing I would plug, if I'm going to say, please do this, if not for me, do it for yourself, is controlled experiments. You can think, one way to think about them is clinical trials for business.
Yes.
A little bit of careful thinking around creating the right comparison group can help you learn more, learn faster, and learn at lower risk than you would otherwise about how new initiatives are or are not going to be successful.
Yeah.
And it's very common to roll them out in a way that, you do it in the area that you think is going to work the best, and you just compare, like, well, is that group or whatever the unit is doing better than it did before? And often that's good enough.
Yeah.
But there's always other things going on at the same time.
Yeah.
So you could actually learn more with more confidence. If you even do a smaller rollout, but make sure that you randomize between, you know, groups or employees or customers who are otherwise identical. Some of them get the new initiative, some don't, and compare them directly to each other. And it's a super simple idea. It's been outrageously successful in science. And it's being done in business, for sure, but I think not being done nearly as much as it should be.
Fantastic. I also think, Peter, is that what you were talking about there about communication and assumptions and stuff, and it makes me think that communication is a bit like modeling and forecasting, in that the results are what you get, but the only thing that you should really be changing or should be thinking about are the assumptions that you make.
Absolutely.
Do you make that? Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. I mean, when you think about how it has this problem, when we're doing analysis and trying to communicate results, either within our own company or externally, that people want to know about confidence, and we have very precise ways of calculating confidence that completely ignore the main source of ambiguity. So when you say the confidence interval is 2.3 or whatever, that's all conditional on your assumptions being perfect.
Yes.
And that's where we just, part of the reason it's hard to communicate is we don't know the right answer about how do you actually judge confidence. But I think that having the right understanding of that problem and always having the check of, do you think this is the way the world works?
Yes.
And explicitly thinking about what are my assumptions going into this. And you always have to make some assumptions. I mean, every model's wrong. Some models are useful.
Yeah.
I forget who I'm paraphrasing there, but being aware of your assumptions in virtually every domain is tremendously useful.
Absolutely. Peter, that's fascinating. I mean, and just in the interest of just thinking about sort of time and stuff, and just don't want to kind of tell everybody about everything that you've done in the research, but want to point them to the research. But and I will point them to the article on the Harvard Business Review. But is there anything else? I mean, this is. Let me back up a little bit. My last question that I always ask people on the blog is sort of this: is there anything else that you'd like to shamelessly plug?
I think I partly already answered that in a strange way with experiments. I guess we'll come back to a few things that I already mentioned, which were communicate more than you think you need to.
Yeah.
And experiment. And I'd be really interested, actually, especially for people in the sort of context that I work the most with, that is sort of focused on customer experience. If you've run controlled experiments, whether they be about the way you collect feedback or even better, something broader about an initiative you've tried in your business, mm-hmm. that you did a simple randomization, mm-hmm. And you found out it worked or didn't, and then what happened afterwards, I'd love to hear more and more of those stories. Because that's a big part of what we and what I'm trying to build. And the more ammunition I have, the better. So,
we'll
reach out and tell me.
Yeah, well, we'll make sure that I'll get that written up and I'll get it edited up, and I'll keep my eyes and ears open for instances of when people have done that, and when I come across them, I'll be sure to share them with you. But
wonderful,
Peter, that's been really fascinating and great talking to you, and thank you for your time today. That's been brilliant.
Great, really appreciate the conversation as well.